Hello, and welcome to the latest Long Distance Law Institute event to mark the release of the 2021 edition of the Pacific Aid Map. A very warm welcome to everyone joining us from Australia, to those dialing in from overseas, and in particular to those connecting from the Pacific. My name is Alexander Dayant, and I am a research fellow in the Pacific Island programs at the Law Institute. Let me begin by acknowledging the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of this land, and pay my respects to the elders, both past and present. Today, we're going to discuss the economic impact the COVID-19 pandemic has had on the Pacific, and look ahead to see what additional economic support is needed in the region. To discuss these issues, I am joined by a stellar panel of guests. From Tuva, we have Zara Khan, the Director of Programs and Initiatives at the Pacific Islands Forum Secretariat. Joining us from Manila is Emma Veve, the Deputy Director General of the Pacific Department at the Asian Development Bank. From Canberra, we have David Osborne, the lead economist of the Office of the Pacific at the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade of Australia. And last but not least, joining us from Sydney is my colleague Roland Raja, the lead economist and director of the International Economics Program at the Law Institute. Thank you all for joining me today. Before we jump into our discussion, I wanted to present the 2021 edition of the Pacific Aid Map. But instead of a long speech, we thought a quick video would do the trick. Here it is.
The Lowy Institute Pacific Aid Map is the world's leading tool for analysing aid flows to the Pacific region. It is the first database that standardises aid data about the Pacific from all donors and centralises it on a single interactive platform. The Pacific Aid Map is made up of more than 20 million data points spanning over a decade, and it traces incoming players in the Pacific to evaluate their imprint and influence. This interactive map shows the overall aid flows into the Pacific region. It allows you to filter based on donors, Pacific countries, sectors, aid types, currency types, and to download all of the information from each section of the map to create your own analysis. You can trace aid projects by diving down to detail on the ground and find individual transaction details. The dashboard allows you to compare donors' aid programs and examine the aid landscape of each Pacific Island country. With the graphing tool, you can create your own trend analysis. The news and analysis page spotlights analytical work that draws on the aid map database. Aid Map has been revolutionary in changing how we think about aid in the Pacific. Not only has the interactive tool and data visualization enabled greater transparency, but it can contribute to greater governance in the region by giving aid agencies and policymakers accurate, current, and reliable data. It also creates an accountability mechanism for donor countries, as the map shows where their work has been implemented and to what scale. But most importantly, the map provides a vital source of information to Pacific Island countries who, equipped with this knowledge, can make more tailored decisions on where future aid should be targeted. By collating information that is available to both the public and private sectors, the map facilitates deeper analysis on how the world can efficiently and productively engage with the Pacific. The map is being used by the aid community on the ground, as well as by policymakers throughout the region. It is updated annually, and each new edition traces how funding has evolved over time.
Pretty cool video. So as you can see, the Pacific Aid Map is the most comprehensive data set on aid to the Pacific ever assembled. But due to the lag in donor reporting, this year's update of the map cover aid comprehensively from 2009 to 2019, which in some ways stopped when things were getting interesting due to the global pandemic. But this doesn't mean there's nothing to learn from this year's release. On the contrary, the Pacific Aid Map gives us a clear trend on how development assistance was being disbursed and used in the region over the past decade. One key finding of this year's edition is that aid has dropped by 15% in 2019 in comparison to the blockbuster year that was 2018 to reach a total of $2.44 billion. Much of this decline was to be expected, with the surge in 2018 being driven by the disbursement of major multilateral lending projects in Fiji and Papua New Guinea that could not be expected to be repeated each year. In addition, 2018 saw one of significant disbursement from the United States to Palau, addressing areas related to the Compact of Free Association. Overall, Eight of the top 10 donors witnessed a contraction of foreign aid in 2019. Despite this decline, aid to the Pacific in 2019 remained 6% greater than in 2017, without adjusting for inflation. However, we can already see signs that 2020 is going to be the highest year on record. So please keep an eye open for next year's edition as well. A second significant finding of this year's edition has to do with China. The Pacific Aid Map is one of the only tools that traces Chinese aid flows to the Pacific. And what we have found this year was surprising. Despite the narrative of China's rising influence in the Pacific in 2019, China has in fact led all bilateral donors in its contraction of aid. Chinese aid to the Pacific shrank by 31% from $246 million in 2018 to $169 million. In 2019. It is its lowest level of aid to the region since 2012, despite having secured two new diplomatic allies in the Solomon Islands and Kiribati. Preliminary analysis for 2020 have seen no significant bounce back either, despite the ongoing economic crisis in the region we will be discussing shortly. The contraction of Chinese aid could be explained by several factors. It could be a result of aid saturation. There's very limited fiscal space remaining for Pacific countries these days, and they are more reluctant to take loans from China. It could be that China has focused its attention somewhere else, like Africa or Southeast Asia. It could also be that Chinese aid has largely served its purpose of injecting Chinese state-owned enterprises into the region. But despite this drop, China is still the fourth largest development partner to the region. And look, there's so much more to impact in this year's edition of the Pacific Aid Map. For instance, the first major geostrategic investments following Australia's Pacific step up, most notably the Coral Sea cables connecting Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands, are starting to appear on the map. So how geopolitics shapes aid investment will be something to watch closely in the coming years. You can also see how much it cost China to convince the Solomon Islands and Kiribati to switch diplomatic allegiance from Taiwan to Beijing. Or you could see how aid to the Pacific has become less generous, with concessional lending taking up a larger overall share of aid to the region. So clearly, there's a lot of insights to be extracted from this year's edition of the Pacific Aid Map. This is why we encourage our audience to download the full data set to make their own analysis. And talking about analysis, I would like now to give the floor to Roland, who is going to present on financing the Pacific economic recovery. Roland, the floor is yours.
Okay, good evening, everyone. What I'm going to do is provide a short presentation based on some of the research we've been doing here at the Institute, looking into the economic impact of COVID-19 in the Pacific and what will be needed in particular to enable the region's recovery in the years ahead. And the key headline message is that the Pacific is currently looking at a potential lost decade of development as a result of the pandemic. And that means the priority is not only about overcoming the immediate crisis, as important as that is, but also about enabling what will necessarily be a multi-year recovery and rebuilding effort in the aftermath. Now, the starting point is recognizing that while this has been a truly immense global economic crisis, it's been a crisis especially in the developing world and especially in the Pacific. If you look at the chart that I've put up here, this shows the economic performance of developing economies in various regions since the pandemic began. And two things immediately jump out at you looking at this chart. First is that the Pacific has genuinely been amongst the hardest hit regions anywhere in the world. The scale of the economic shock in 2020 was as bad as it was in South Asia, almost as bad as it was in Latin America and the Caribbean, and much worse than it was in Southeast Asia or sub-Saharan Africa. And if you consider some of the individual Pacific Island countries, particularly those that are the most tourism dependent, such as Fiji, Palau, and the Cook Islands, the scale of the economic collapse has simply been staggering, on the order of 20 to 30% of GDP, easily making these countries amongst those most badly affected anywhere in the world. Now, the second thing that jumps out at you looking at this chart is that while the rest of the world is already rebounding and recovering, in the Pacific, the recovery is yet to begin. And there are a number of reasons for that. First, while the Pacific did well last year to avoid major domestic outbreaks of the virus, that wasn't the case this year, with Fiji notably experiencing a terrible crisis a few months ago, and PNG still in a very worrying situation today. Secondly, the recovery in international tourism is obviously going to take a lot longer than the recovery in other parts of the global economy. And according to industry surveys by the World Tourism Organization, for instance, most of the industry thinks that international tourism won't recover to its 2019 levels until sometime in 2024 or later. So the recovery in international tourism is still a long way away, and that means economic recovery for many of the tourism-dependent Pacific Island economies is also a long time away. And finally, as the Pacific is generally an aid-dependent region, Pacific Island governments simply haven't been able to engage in the kind of large-scale increases in government spending that we've seen in the rich world, as well as some of the stronger emerging market economies, in order to keep their households, firms, and economies afloat through the worst parts of the crisis and to enable the recovery thereafter. Some Pacific governments have been able to increase spending, but not to the extent needed. Meanwhile, others like Fiji and PNG have been struggling just to keep overall spending levels at pre-pandemic levels. Now, as an aid-dependent region, the international response in terms of providing emergency financial support was always going to be absolutely central to the Pacific's ability to get through this crisis. At the Lowy Institute, we've been tracking this, and by our estimate, the scale of support so far reached has been about $3.3 billion, or about 10% of the region's GDP. Now, that's quite significant, and it's come from a variety of sources, but the problem is that in the end, it simply just hasn't been enough. It pales in comparison to the scale of the crisis at hand, and has also been very uneven across countries, being very large relative to some of the smaller Pacific Island economies, but then much less significant relative to some of the larger ones like PNG and Fiji. And finally, the important thing is that the financing challenges facing the Pacific are also likely to last for many years ahead. But there are big question marks about whether the international financial support will be there to match that need. And if not, then Pacific Island governments could find themselves forced to undergo deep spending cuts at a time when their economies would still be significantly depressed. Of course, just like everywhere else, vaccines are absolutely essential to enabling the region's recovery. And indeed, there can be no end to the immediate crisis without them. Fortunately, the vaccine picture in the Pacific is somewhat more positive, although still quite mixed. If you look at the chart here, this shows the percentage of the population that has been vaccinated with at least one dose of vaccine. And I've shown the Pacific Island countries in dark blue, and then I've also included a few international comparators as benchmarks, Singapore and Israel as top performers, Australia as a middling performer, and then Indonesia as a major developing country that has been struggling with its vaccine rollout. And as you can see, in general, most of the Pacific is actually doing quite well by international comparison, thanks in large part to the ample provision of vaccine doses from development partners, as well as the COVAX initiative. And as a result, some of the richer microstates are doing amongst the best in the world, such as Palau, Niue, and Nauru. And countries like Fiji and Cook Islands are also doing extremely well. And then even amongst the group of Pacific countries that are doing worse than Australia, like Tuvalu, Samoa, and Tonga, at least these still compare somewhat favorably compared to a lot of other developing countries, such as Indonesia in the chart. On the other hand, of course, there are several Pacific Island countries that are really struggling with the vaccine rollout. That includes Kiribati, Vanuatu, Solomon Islands, and especially PNG, where only 1% of the population has received at least one dose of the vaccine. And of course, that's especially worrying because PNG is where most of the Pacific population is, and it's in the middle of a domestic COVID outbreak right now as well. And unfortunately, the barriers there seem to be a lot more than just about access to enough vaccines, and instead also reflect very complex issues around high vaccine hesitancy, limited healthcare capacity, and the difficulty of reaching remote populations. Vanuatu's situation also stands out as particularly problematic, given the importance of tourism to its economy and the risk that a slow vaccine rollout there could delay its ability to reopen its borders. Now, looking to the longer term, last year we published a policy brief where we argued that based on the outlook at the time, the Pacific was facing a potential lost decade due to the pandemic, with real GDP per capita, or roughly speaking, average income per person, not expected to recover to its pre-pandemic 2019 level until sometime around 2028, as you can see in the red line in this chart. Now, almost a year has passed since we made that negative assessment, but so far that assessment unfortunately is basically held up. And if anything, things have probably gotten slightly worse since then. And what that means is that the Pacific Island economies will likely remain depressed for many years to come. And what that means in more practical terms is more people in basic needs poverty, high rates of unemployment, not enough jobs being created to absorb all the young people in the Pacific that are entering the workforce each year, depressed government revenue that will make it difficult to finance key basic services, especially in health and education, and thereby making it difficult to achieve objectives like the Sustainable Development Goals. And ultimately, all of this potentially feeding into future social and political problems. And of course, there are still plenty of risks that this basic baseline outlook could prove worse than it seems, including due to the risk of course, dangerous new variants emerging, or more general global economic risks, such as those currently emanating out of the Chinese property sector. And finally, of course, the tourism recovery is just very uncertain and could easily take much longer than expected. So what can be done to enable a stronger recovery? I mean, obviously overcoming the immediate crisis is paramount, particularly through the rollout of vaccines and safely reopening to international travel for tourism, as well as seasonal work purposes. But beyond that, in our policy brief last year, we estimated that the Pacific would need about $3.5 billion in additional multi-year financing for recovery and rebuilding after the pandemic. This needed to be above and beyond what the Pacific was otherwise expected to receive, and would allow the Pacific to avoid the need for damaging fiscal austerity and instead allow for productive investments in things like infrastructure, climate resilience, and health and education. The goal would be to effectively shift the Pacific off the red line in the chart and back onto the blue line that would represent a full recovery from the crisis. Now, unfortunately, since we made that call, the only major new international financial support that has been provided has been the roughly $700 million in IMF special drawing rights that were allocated last month, which, whilst still significant, still leaves a large financing gap of at least another $2.8 billion, and realistically, probably more. So where could that potentially come from? Well, ultimately, it would need to come from the region's bilateral development partners, one way or another. That could be done, for instance, directly through the provision of more grants and concessional loans. That's something that the Australian government has already been doing to some extent. And in our policy brief last year, we suggested that Australia should ramp this up into a $2 billion multi-year recovery facility for the Pacific. Alternatively, bilateral donors could channel their support through the multilateral system in various ways, through either the multilateral development banks or the IMF, probably better in my view if it went through the banks. And finally, it could also take the form of debt relief, which could be particularly helpful for countries like Tonga, Samoa, and Vanuatu that face large impending debt servicing payments in the coming years, particularly for some of the large China Exim Bank loans that they've taken on in the past. But ultimately, while there are better and worse ways to do it, the key point is that the Pacific is going to need a lot more outside help if it is going to recover and rebuild after the pandemic and avoid what could otherwise be a lost decade of development. For the region's development partners interested in the Pacific's well-being, stability, and prosperity, that is something that should be seen as well worth investing in. Thanks, and I'll leave it there, and I look forward to the discussion with our panel of experts. Thanks, Alex. Back to you.
Thank you, Roland. Let's jump straight into our panelists for this up. So first, I wanted to ask you, Zarak, how do you see the COVID-19 crisis and the economic outlook in the Pacific? I mean, what is the issue of most pressing concerns from PIF's perspective?
Well, thank you very much, Alex. May I firstly just thank the Lowy Institute for the invitation to be part of this esteemed panel, and also for the great presentation from Roland, and for the launch of your Pacific Aid Map, which is an excellent toolkit, an instrument used by policymakers in the region to develop policies. And certainly it's featured in terms of the research that we've done for foreign economic ministers meetings and other ministerial engagements. Now, in specific response to your question, I think many of you may be aware that the Forum Island countries in particular are very highly vulnerable to exogenous shocks, whether it's due to natural disasters that are climate induced or due to their smallness and dependence on external economies, particularly for trade and for basically sustenance. Now, these inherent vulnerabilities very much came to the fore when the COVID-19 pandemic struck the region last year. As you know, most of the countries in the region closed their borders around March 2020, and since then have suffered tremendous economic losses. In terms of 2020, the regional economy contracted by about 5%, and it's projected to grow by only 0.3% in 2021. Now, this has had a very tremendous impact in terms of the livelihoods of our Pacific Islanders, the ability to earn an income, and unfortunately has led to a significant increase in poverty across the region. And certainly this was also highlighted in the latest household and income expenditure survey that was done in Fiji, which showed that even before COVID, the poverty levels were hovering around 30%. And so this is a cause for concern for our economic ministers across the region, certainly for a lot of policymakers. And I think Roland highlighted a few of these key issues in his presentation. Now, in terms of the responses at the national level first, I think many of you may know that our countries have been spending a lot of money over the last 12 to 18 months to try and ensure they can keep their economies afloat, they can keep services running to their people. Mm-hmm. They've spent over $4 billion US dollars in terms of social protection measures, direct support in terms of welfare assistance, and having accommodative monetary policies, and also easing financial and banking requirements when it comes to repayment of home loans, for example, and other measures using their superannuation schemes. But given the limited fiscal and policy space for a lot of our countries, unfortunately, most of the funding that has been used to finance a lot of these arrangements have been through concessional loans. And I think Roland highlighted quite a bit of that in his presentation. In fact, the latest assessment that was done by the World Bank shows that 13 of our countries in the Pacific region are classified in the high debt distress classification. This is according to the debt sustainability analysis. Now, this is compared to just 6 countries in 2019 before the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of the countries have borrowed, and quite a few of them. Now, the debt to GDP ratio is hovering anywhere between 60 to 80% or even more now, depending on the latest figures that we can get access to. In terms of concrete solutions that can be offered by our development partners, certainly they have a big role to play. We welcome the efforts, particularly in terms of supporting countries with vaccinations and the supply of vaccines, but a lot more needs to be done, particularly when it comes to exploring innovative financing options, including grant financing, direct budget support, as well as other innovative financing initiatives, such as debt for climate and resilience swaps to support our Pacific Island countries. A lot of the countries, unfortunately, have been a victim to the reclassification or restructure of how countries are classified in terms of their levels of development. So you may know that a lot of countries in the region have been graduated from LDC status into developing country status, while still retaining a lot of the unfortunate indicators that show that they haven't really developed. And unfortunately, what this means is that in order to access loans, they have to pay higher interest rates. In order to do trade, unfortunately, they have to incur higher tariffs for their products. And so we really need to revisit how we classify Pacific countries. And it's unfortunate quite a few of them have been classified as upper high-income countries as well. And in terms of the recovery from COVID-19, certainly we're all relying on a vaccine-powered regional economic recovery. It's good to see the news coming out of Australia and New Zealand, particularly Australia, that the Australian economy is looking to open up towards the end of this year. Certainly for most Pacific Island countries which are tourism dependent, they rely on Australia and on New Zealand as well for visitors. So we are keeping a keen watch on that. But we certainly feel that the responsibility lies on the countries that are part of the G7 and the G20 to respond to the needs of the small island developing states, which includes the Pacific region. Lastly, in terms of specifically what the forum is doing to support our member states, you'd recall that the forum leaders invoked the Big Ottawa Declaration last year in March 2020, which brought about the establishment of the Pacific Humanitarian Pathway, or the PHPC, as we like to call it. This has resulted in the movement of over 300 tons of health and humanitarian supplies across the Pacific region, including the movement of over 115 health professionals to countries that need them the most. In addition to that, we've established through the Foreign Economic Ministers, the COVID-19 Economic Recovery Task Force, which is taking a very keen look and exploring regional solutions, particularly to the debt situation, and also how we can support MSME businesses across the Pacific region as well. Other areas that you may be aware of include the development and finalization of the 2050 strategy for the Blue Pacific continent. We're hoping that we can get this concluded and it can be discussed at the next Pacific Islands Forum Leaders meeting, which Fiji will be hosting and is looking at hosting in the early part of 2022. We also have a freight assistance package that we've rolled out to MSME businesses, and we're looking to top up with the support of our development partners. And lastly, we're looking at convening a regional debt conference for Forum Island countries and the creditors in early 2022. We're looking at partnering with a lot of our different agencies across the region, the crop agencies, but also UN agencies, to see how we can organize this very quickly, noting that the countries are in a dire situation at the moment. And lastly, we'd encourage our friends in Australia and New Zealand to please favorably consider the travel bubbles. This is essential to life in the Pacific, especially for our tourism industry. And that is something that would be very much welcomed to try and ensure that we can get on the path to recovery. Thank you very much, Alex.
Yeah, well, thank you, Zarek. I mean, I personally hope for the travel bubble as well. But now, Emma, I'd like to bring you in the conversation. The Asian Development Bank has delivered a robust package of additional support to the Pacific to date. What is your assessment of the economic situation in the region? And do you think our estimate of $3.5 billion in additional support are in the ballpark of what more support is needed?
Thank you. And let me thank you for inviting me to this event and congratulate Loi on the release of your new Pacific Aid Map, which is a really useful tool for everyone involved in aid in the Pacific. Look, the economic outlook for the Pacific, I think I've been working in the region for quite some time, and it's perhaps the most difficult time to be forecasting just what expectations are for the region. I think governments have struggled to operate under a whole range of thinking through different scenarios. There's been a number of expectations that haven't come to fruition of, borders being likely to open up, but we've moved from one expected horizon to the next. So we've had 18 months now of largely border closures across the region. That's had a significant impact on growth during 2020. We saw the worst contraction ever experienced by the Pacific region. For some countries, their financial year 2021 growth rates are going to be even worse. The contractions experienced are even worse. So I think bouncing back from such a significant fall is going to require considerable external support. I think that the numbers you pointed to, 3.5 billion or so, are probably as good an estimate as any. I think from ADB's perspective, in 2020 alone, we committed over $1 billion US in new funds to the region. That's a substantial amount of money, but when you look how much more there is to do, certainly the need is very much there, and it's across a greater range of sectors and issues than we've perhaps had to work in the recent past. Of course, we're seeing need for support for budgets and for the rollout of COVID response plans. But we're seeing governments needing technical support in areas where perhaps they've not been so active. I think social protection is the headline one among this. We're also looking governments' requests to help them work with businesses. How do you identify the best ways to help businesses through this period when you don't know how long the period is? And initially the intent is let's help all businesses, let's make payments to businesses. But over time, it's like, which businesses do we focus on to give us the best position to come out of this economic shock once we can start to reopen borders? So there's been very much a shift in thinking of where the need is. And ongoing needs in the health sector, and will continue to be needs in the health sector. We've seen the costs of rolling out the current vaccination program. If countries are looking at regular booster shots, say on an annual basis, this is a significant cost that's going to have to be met, largely through national budgets in future years. So I think all of these things really do add up to perhaps an even greater number than you pointed to. So there's very much to be done in the region, and that's just the COVID response. I think we can look at this as practice for a climate change disaster in the region, and that's going to be even more difficult to deal with and require even more resources. And still needs planning for while we're dealing with the shock that has been COVID. Thanks.
Yeah, well, yeah, thanks, Emma. I mean, just to rebound on your 1 billion commitment to the region, this is actually thanks to the ADB's very good reporting mechanism. This is something that we can already trace in the Pacific Aid Map. We see that, the ADB has committed more than 1 billion in 2020. And like actually the disbursement of the ADB in 2020 was also very much, much bigger than any other years. So this is very welcome. Now, Dave, I'd like to come to you. Australia has been providing a lot of support, either through reprogramming aid to budget support, guaranteeing vaccine supply to the region, or through direct lending activities. But none of these will be as impactful as reopening Australia's border to the region. So what do you see as being the biggest impediments to get people moving into the region again?
Okay, thanks, Alex, and thank you, and hi to all the other panelists. And also, I will say firstly, congratulations on the Lowy Pacific Aid Map. It's an excellent contribution to data transparency, and others have mentioned it's a great tool for doing assessment work, but also the much needed support and understanding for all of our programming. So well done there. Supporting the safe opening of the region is an absolute priority. As we are looking back 18 months, as Emma has already mentioned, we saw that this shock into the region would be a short-term shock. It would be a temporary closure of borders. What has transpired is very different, of course. What we are now seeing is the ADB and other forecasters of economic growth saying that 2021 will continue to see contractions across many of the countries. And now, I'll just note, most recently, just this week, the ADB have come out and said there will now be a contraction in the region for 2021, having previously said that there'll be a small level of growth. Now, that is all about the closure of borders, as we know. So the important thing to note is that as vaccine rates increase in Australia and across the region, we are starting to see more positive signs around the growth prospects for 2022. So in the revision by the ADB, we see a continued positive outlook, and that is entirely against the growth in vaccine rates, and also the preparedness of industry and sectors across the region to be able to manage COVID and the impacts of COVID. So in particular, when you look at a country by country analysis of the region, you have to look to which countries will be impacted most by a reopening. And first and foremost, as others have mentioned, we're really looking to the tourism-based economies. Now, I will note that all economies across the Pacific do have a tourism sector, but it's really Fiji and Vanuatu that have the predominant tourism sectors. Now, they will be most reliant on the opening of travel. Now, travel, it's a two-way situation in terms of border restrictions. If you look to PNG now having just announced overnight that they will now step down the quarantine requirements for travellers entering the country who are vaccinated. Now that's a fantastic move for PNG, for the business community, for tourists, for PNG nationals looking obviously to get back into the country and to have more freedom of movement. And that will have a positive economic impact. We do note that the very strong vaccination rates in Fiji and the ADB has made that noted to that in their most recent update about the impact, that positive impact that will have on growth. And looking to 2022, they are forecasting around an 8.8% growth response. And that will then lead into a response in the fiscal environment and a response also to the issue that was raised previously about debt sustainability. Yes, the region has had to increase financing. They've had to borrow more. Many countries have had to borrow more to be able to fund the critical services. And that does increase the risk on debt sustainability, and with GDP falling as well, that does increase it. But at the same time, when we start to see that recovery, we should see that pressure coming off. And I'll just make one mention of the fiscal gap and just Roland's presentation, which is an excellent presentation, really highlighting that this is a multi-year recovery and that vaccines are essential to this recovery. But the vaccine gap is large. The financing gap is large. We knew that from the beginning. Immediately when the restrictions hit in March of last year, my team and the Office of the Pacific in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade rapidly moved to designing an immediate support package of $100 million to be able to immediately respond to the cash shortages in the region, because we knew that impact that would occur from the shutting down of borders. As I said, it's expanded out to a much longer term. So we have scaled up both on the grant side with an additional $304 million package in terms of our loans into the region. The ADB has done so that Emma had mentioned, the IMF, the World Bank, the AIIB, and other partners like Japan and New Zealand have significantly increased their support into the region, specifically for this COVID shock. And also the debt sustainability service suspension initiative. Sorry, the debt service suspension initiative has been a really important initiative to reduce that debt burden, to reduce the pressure through this shock. But Roland is right. We have to keep looking to the future. It is now a multi-year recovery, and we need to make sure that we are designing our responses and that we've got the fiscal support so that the tail of this shock doesn't last longer than it needs to. And we need to reduce the length of that tail.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Now, look, one of the advantages of taking our events online is we can actually draw the Pacific closer into our events with some recorded questions from the region. The first one is from Maho Lavelle, a lecturer in economics at the School of Business and Public Policy at the University of Papua New Guinea. Let's listen to him.
Hi, I'm Maho Lavelle, an economics lecturer at the University of Papua New Guinea. So in 2020 and 2021, PNG will have had three major lockdowns. The Bank of PNG has responded by easing monetary policy starting in April last year through reducing the Kina facility rate from 5% to 3%, reducing the cash reserve requirement from 7% to 4%, and engaging in quantitative easing. Commercial banks have followed suit by reducing their indicator lending rate or their interest rates on most financial products. However, we do not see an uptake in loans from the private sector as a response to those fallen interest rates. We did see formal sector employment, though, fall by 10,000, according to one conservative estimate. This is concerning given private sector accounts for 70% of all formal sector employment. So my question is, given monetary policy is ineffective in PNG, what policies are available to the PNG government and how can donors help?
So what tools does the government of Papua New Guinea have to boost the economy in the country and what can development partners do to help? David, you have extensive experience working on PNG. Would you like to give this question a try?
Yeah, thanks, Alex, and thank you. It's an excellent question. It certainly gets to the core of the issue. Economies globally have used monetary policy with fiscal policy to affect a response to an unprecedented shock. Now, PNG, I certainly would question the conclusion of monetary policy being ineffective. We have to look to what were they trying to achieve with the monetary policy steps taken, and really looking at what would have been the case if those three steps weren't taken, we would have potentially seen a greater level of bankruptcies or even further unemployment. So I would say that monetary policy has been effective, but it's constrained. And ultimately, what we've seen through this shock has been a loss of confidence as risks have increased. Now, the Bank of Papua New Guinea has used its tools to maintain confidence, and that flowed through to the commercial sector, to the commercial banks, to enable them to support businesses, to give them moratoriums on repayment of loans, to provide them with cheaper loans of their existing financing, and that enabled those businesses to weather the initial parts of the shock and to continue to do so. So I would say that it has been effective. Monetary policy is probably a blunter tool than we would like. However, then you have to look to what are the fiscal policy responses as well. And I think that's really what policies are available to PNG, noting that it's in a constrained fiscal environment. It came into the crisis with a fiscal deficit, but it came in with relatively low levels of debt. And that has enabled PNG to increase its financing and to maintain its expenditure. It hasn't been able to do what many developed economies have done, which is to provide fiscal stimulus, which is spending in addition to their original level of spending. They have been constrained. However, the reprioritization of funding to areas that will get that will maintain the economic activity. As we have seen, government has become a larger part of the demand in the economy. So that's a really important measure, but it has to be done carefully, obviously, to maintain that debt sustainability. What can donors do to help continue to deliver the programs that we and others have in place? We've got a long history of delivering with the PNG government in health, education, infrastructure, law and justice, and other sectors, support the government through the health measures and in particular through vaccines to, again, reduce the harm in the economy, to increase the likelihood of a faster recovery once borders start to reopen fully. We are starting to see that gradual reopening in PNG. And then off the back of this, making sure that there are steps are taken to support households, whether it be through social protection initiatives or businesses directly.
Roland, would you like to add to this, or should I jump to the next question?
I'll just add a couple of quick points. I mean, I agree with a lot of what Dave had to say. You know, I think often the hope is that, you know, people might say, I'll look to sort of strengthening the business environment and undertaking various reforms in order to get the private sector going. But the reality is that in the short term, you know, even the most worthwhile reforms of that nature basically don't pay the kind of dividends that you need. Mm-hmm. They don't provide the support in the short term. So there's a problem there, still maybe worth doing, but doesn't get you to your short-term solution. Really, this is a situation where a sort of Keynesian economic response, policy response is required. But the reality is PNG, like the rest of the region and a lot of other lower income countries, are, you know, very fiscally constrained. And so there's an important sort of nexus here between what the government can and is willing to do and what donors in the international community can do as well. I mean, the more the government is able to develop and create a credible medium-term recovery plan, the better it will be and easier it will be for them to be able to turn to the international community and to donors and probably with the involvement of the IMF to try and get the additional financing unlocked that can enable them to provide that kind of short-term support to the economy that they'll need over the next couple of years. And inevitably, that will also involve undertaking some of those deeper structural reforms as well, but over a longer time frame, and knowing that the benefits of that will take place over a longer time frame.
All right, thank you, Roland. Let's jump straight to the next question. So the other one is on tourism, and it's from Kelvin Anthony, a freelance journalist based in Fiji.
Travel and tourism have been the lifeline for the region, but the pandemic has shown that it's a vulnerable sector. Now, international travel won't return to pre-pandemic levels in the short-term future. So how can Pacific nations reinvent their economies that does not rely on international tourism? Do Pacific states even have the option to do that?
Emma, can I direct this question to you?
Yeah, thanks, Alex. Look, for many Pacific countries, tourism really has been the driver of growth. And while having to close borders has absolutely just stopped tourism in its tracks, and how soon people will be willing to leave the safety of their homes and go back and explore the world is a question, and the thinking is that it's possibly longer than those tourism-based countries would hope. We might be looking a good couple of years before things return to anything like pre-pandemic levels. I wouldn't say that therefore we should write off the tourism industry. I think it's going to remain important for many of the Pacific countries. And in the short term, as they really work hard to open travel corridors, we've seen Palau and the Cook Islands do this with mixed level of success. But certainly in the experience of the Cook Islands, when they did manage to open up to New Zealand before Auckland went into another lockdown, they saw tourism levels at about two-thirds of pre-pandemic levels. Now, this was because they were the only overseas option on the table at that time. But I think this, you know, the ability to open quickly and be, you know, amongst the sort of first countries to do so, plus the selling point of having not experienced COVID in country, I think makes the Pacific a fairly attractive destination for people. And I think that that can be used as a strong selling point. And of course, there's all the investments that governments have been making to ensure that happens. You know, investments in restructuring of the way airports look to make the necessary space to keep people socially distanced, et cetera, ensuring the health facilities are up to standard to treat any cases that do enter the country. So I think all this is really important, as well as training people in the tourism, hospitality, retail sectors as to what they need to be doing. But that said, you know, it's always important to be on the lookout for other revenue-earning opportunities. I think what we've seen during COVID is that the fisheries sector remained, you know, in comparison, relatively untouched. Yes, there were some struggles, you know, manning boats, how to service boats, etc. during COVID, but ways were worked around this. And so I think certainly the fisheries industry really is something that's going to remain quite critical to the Pacific, and looking to see how you can expand engagement in that sector, you know, onshore processing, providing services to the shipping fleet, etc. are potential ways for some Pacific countries to keep expanding their revenues from that sector. I think the other thing that we're going to be seeing governments focus on to try and get their economies to bounce back more quickly is investments in infrastructure. I mean, these are a good, sensible, needed investments at the best of times, but they provide also some quick cash into the economy through payment of construction workers, et cetera, and can really help to bring an economy back to pre-COVID levels quicker than without it. But again, of course, this involves the opening of borders. If you open to tourists, it also helps you open to all of the foreign workers that these small islands may need to help reboost their growth. So tourism, absolutely essential, but I think there's other opportunities also to help growth in the region. Thanks.
Mm. Yeah. Thanks, Emma. Zarek, I mean, you live in one of those economies. What are your thoughts?
Thanks, Alex. I think those are some valid points that were made by Emma in relation to having a look at tourism holistically, but other sectors that countries need to have a look at closely now, noting our experiences with COVID and the impact that it has on the sector. I think that's a great question by Kelvin in terms of Fiji. Fiji, as you know, is reliant on tourism. It supports close to over 40% of its GDP, directly contributes about 100,000 personnel in terms of employment, but even more so when it comes to the indirect employment created through tourism. And unfortunately, you know, as you mentioned, of being on the ground in Fiji, you can see so many people have lost their jobs because of the closure of resorts, the lockdown restrictions in place, and the ceasing of international travel. A lot of people have been let go from the national airline, Fiji Airways, and it's slowly now starting to, I guess, you know, show some semblance of normality, but people have been doing it tough for the last 12 to 18 months. One of the key priorities for our forum economic ministers has been to try and identify other pillars of growth that can support tourism. And one of the things that we're looking at very closely now is on the digital economy and e-commerce. So we have the Pacific Aid for Trade strategy, which was endorsed by our trade ministers last year. And one of the key deliverables on that has been the Pacific e-commerce strategy and roadmap, which was approved by our ministers this year. What we're hoping to do is have a look at some of the structural impediments which have prevented our Pacific Island economies from penetrating the e-commerce market. As you know, in Australia and New Zealand and a lot of the developed economies, as soon as the lockdown restrictions came into being, businesses went online and were able to continue the businesses in some shape or form. Unfortunately, this was not the reality on the ground in the Pacific. Most businesses had to close and had to bide their time until vaccination rates have been up to the levels governments have asked for before they can slowly open up. And so things we're looking at is including cybersecurity legislation. We're looking at issues related to payment systems and payment gateways. Looking at the regulatory and legislative frameworks in the countries to protect consumers and businesses. And we're hoping to capitalize on a lot of the investments that have been done by our development partners, particularly in terms of submarine cables and internet connectivity. We know that ADB, for example, and DFAT in Australia have been working through PRIF and other initiatives to support our countries, the World Bank as well. We want to make sure that our Pacific economies can take advantage of the infrastructure that has been brought in and make sure that we can encourage them to start online businesses, encourage our young entrepreneurs across the region to look at app development, software development, encourage more call centers and back office operations to look at the Pacific as a viable destination. So I think to respond to the question, definitely the digital economy and e-commerce is a sector we're looking at closely. Thank you, Alex.
Well, thank you, Zarek. Now, our final question today comes from Anna Naupa in Vanuatu. Anna is the country director for Vanuatu and Nauru at APTC, the Australian Pacific Training Coalition, and was also a former colleague of yours, Zarek, at the PIF Secretariat. So you might have to answer this question as well.
My name is Anna Naupa from Vanuatu. Thank you to the Lowy and the panelists for this interesting topic today. The question I have is, how much of a shift away from the neoliberal capitalist model of development and continuous pursuit of positive economic growth does the pandemic offer us? What advice would you be giving to Pacific Island policymakers who have experienced severe economic downturns in many sectors since the advent of the pandemic? How much of a rethinking of the development model can we anticipate and push for in this context?
Tough question. So Zarek, if you wanna give it a go, and after I'll ask Roland quickly as well.
Sure, thanks, Alex. I think that's a great question from Anna Naupa, and something that definitely our leaders and ministers should take a closer look at. I think when you look at not just the impact of the pandemic, but also the impact of climate-induced disasters that have struck the Pacific region for over a decade now, the traditional, the conventional economic model doesn't work for us. I mean, Cyclone Winston, for example, that hit Fiji back in 2016, wiped almost two-thirds of Fiji's GDP off the map. And then Fiji's expected to recover from this disaster, borrow more money. And then we had another few disasters hitting over the last few years. And then you have to borrow more money again to rebuild. And it's a continuous cycle of catastrophic debt. And it's not just Fiji, but you've got countries like Vanuatu, Tonga, Samoa, hit by tropical cyclones, tsunamis, and a number of constant disasters that unfortunately face or confront the Pacific region. And so what are we expected to do in terms of making sure that we can take care of our people, take care of the needs when it comes to the education sector, the health sector, while also trying to rebuild the infrastructure, which is quite crucial to connectivity. And so this is where financing for development, I think, comes into play. And I think responding to Anna's question specifically, the usual mode of doing business or business as usual no longer works for us. And this is why I think this is an important opportunity through this platform, but also other platforms where we need to encourage our development partners, our major lenders, our major creditors, to have a relook at the global economic structure and how small island developing states and those who are less well off sort of fit into that picture and fit into that puzzle. Because if we continue down the track that we're going, the countries in the Pacific region, as well as other small island developing states, will continue to build up big stockpiles of debt, continue to be indebted. And unfortunately, this is a debt that will make our future generations vulnerable and something that we need to resolve now and not in the future. Thank you, Alex.
Yeah, thank you, Zarek. Roland, some closing words on how to rethink development?
Yeah, I mean, some great points there by Zarek. I mean, obviously, within the global, the international economic system, I mean, climate change and dealing with the global commons in that way is just so absolutely central for the Pacific. But of course, you know, a lot of, you know, effects of climate change are going to come through, it seems, one way or another. They already are. And so adaptation and resilience is absolutely central to the Pacific's future. Regardless of how much mitigation ends up being done, it's still going to be absolutely essential. So that's a key component and two, you know, important elements of what the international community should definitely be thinking about. You know, I think, you know, the Pacific has never sort of operated according to the conventional kind of development paradigm, but nonetheless, it still operates within a broader international intellectual paradigm, which, you know, is driven by mainstream economics. And some people might call that neoliberal or they might not. The reality is it's not about economic growth. What it is about is about efficiency, and it's about creating opportunity. Looking at measures like GDP, they're pretty, you know, admittedly I use those numbers, but they're pretty dodgy numbers in the Pacific to begin with. But the reality is it's just a bit of a useful metric that one can use. What you're really interested in is where's opportunity coming from? Where are the jobs coming from? Where's the revenue to support the services? You know, those sorts of questions. That's what, you know, people are really interested in, I think. You know, and the reality is that the Pacific is an extremely difficult environment for all the obvious reasons of smallness and remoteness and so on. But it has a lot of advantages. And I think the key thing is making as much use of those advantages as possible. It's about, you know, labor mobility schemes, for example, are a huge opportunity for many Pacific workers. Tourism, sure, you can use those options between mass tourism and premium and ecotourism. Governance, you know, just getting basic public services operating as well as possible. These things, you know, are absolutely, you know, essential, you know, whether or not they're the traditional economic paradigm, you know, or not, that's where opportunity and living standards are going to come from. And I think that's, you know, where people are going to have to look.
Thank you very much, Roland. This is a very nice and positive point to end this conversation. Because yes, this is all that we have time for today. Thank you very much to our panelists for this stimulating and wide-ranging conversation. We would also like to thank our viewers for tuning in and being part of this journey with us. And a special thanks to Maho, Kelvin, and Anna for their brilliant questions. See you at the next Long Distance Lowy Institute event.